hikes on imports from many countries, including China, under the pretext of reciprocity. This gravely violates World Trade Organization WTO rules and undermines the rules-based multilateral trading system. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Guo Jiakun added, China firmly rejects this and will do what is necessary to defend our legitimate rights and interests. We have emphasized more than once that trade and tariff wars have no winners. Protectionism leads nowhere. We urge the United States to stop doing the wrong thing and resolve trade differences with China and other countries through consultations with equality, respect, and mutual benefit. The 34% tariffs announced against China on Wednesday come in addition to the 20% tariffs already imposed against the country by the Trump administration. Representative Jeff Van Drew, Republican of New Jersey, told Fox Business Channel, "We knew this was going to be a little bit bumpy in the beginning, but let's understand what it's all about. It's about fairness. It's about America first and not America last. We have been getting the short end of the stick for years, and it's important that Americans understand this. These are reciprocal tariffs. We have been tariffed. Our goods are tariffed. We're always at the unfair disadvantage with these countries, so it's going to be a little bumpy. They're going to cry. They're going to yell," he added. "I spoke to President Trump personally yesterday. He was telling me that already countries are coming to him saying, let's work this out. We can make a fair deal. We can do better. We will do better. Everybody just hold on a little bit. Be a little bit strong. Wall Street will come back. But this is also about Main Street. This is about making things in America." President Trump touted his sweeping tariff plan at a Make America Wealthy Again event, arguing that it will restore the American dream and bolster jobs for U.S. workers. American steel workers, auto workers, farmers, and skilled craftsmen. We have a lot of them here with us today. They really suffered gravely. They watched in anguish as foreign leaders have stolen our jobs. Foreign cheaters have ransacked our factories, and foreign scavengers have torn apart our once beautiful American dream. We had an American dream that you don't hear so much about these days. You did 4 years ago, and you are now, but you don't too often. But now it's our turn to prosper, and in doing so, use trillions and trillions of dollars to reduce our taxes and pay down our national debt. President Trump added, "And it will all happen very quickly. With today's action, we're finally going to be able to make America great again, greater than ever before. Jobs and factories will come roaring back into our country, and you'll see it happening already. We will supercharge our domestic industrial base." The trade announcements have sparked uncertainty about the cost of goods to Americans, which White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt brushed aside on Tuesday at a press conference, arguing the tariff plan is going to work. The American newspaper The Wall Street Journal has also covered President Trump's latest tariffs and how international markets have reacted. A sharp rise in trade war intensity sent Wall Street spiraling on Friday, 4th of April, pushing the Nasdaq index into a bear market, denoting a 20% decline from its peak. China's decision to apply a 34% levy to all imported goods from the United States next Thursday, 10th of April, after President Donald Trump's tariffs go into effect, rattled international markets in part because it further deflated hopes that a global settlement could be reached soon. Further hitting sentiment, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, said the U.S. economy was more likely to face a period of higher prices and weaker growth than seemed possible a few weeks ago, because of larger-than-anticipated tariff hikes. The Standard & Poor's 500 index dropped 6%, the Nasdaq slid 5.8%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 2,231 points. The carnage was widespread, with 14 Standard & Poor's 500 stocks rising for the day and 28 dropping 10% or more. The market-wide toll from a two-day tariff rout surged to a record $6.6 trillion. The torrent of selling late this week shows investors coming to grips with the grim implications of the standoff. The levies announced late on Wednesday were deeper and more aggressive than the business world had expected. Retaliation stands to intensify the economic effects of the policies, which could reduce consumer income and slow economic growth. Now investors are bracing for further conflict, none of which is likely to improve the outlook for the global economy or corporate profits, the strongest driver of stock prices. Even as President Trump left the door open to making deals, he vowed new tariffs on drugs and microchips. Investors took little comfort from Donald Trump's stated willingness to negotiate. J.P. Morgan Chase analyst on Thursday boasted that their odds on a global recession has now increased to 60%. President Trump remained unbowed, saying that now is a great time to get rich and that China played it wrong. They panicked. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, acknowledged that markets are crashing, but said economies weren't and that global businesses would adjust to the new environment. Investors drew little solace from an unexpectedly strong jobs report. That showed the economy added 228,000 jobs last month, giving little sign that uncertainty ahead of the tariff rollout had derailed the labor market. On Friday, 4th of April, major U.S. indices opened sharply lower before staging a modest recovery late in the morning after President Trump said Vietnam's leader wants to cut its tariffs to zero. Another mild rally pushed prices off their lows later on in the day. Overseas markets took fresh hits, with European stocks tumbling more than 4%. Traders have ramped up bets on interest rate cuts this year, figuring the U.S. Federal Reserve will have to shore up the economy. Oil prices slid further, with benchmark U.S. crude falling to about $62 a barrel, its lowest level since 2021. Investors rushed into the treasuries, pushing 10-year yields well below 4% before they drifted back up late on Friday. Bonds in other big economies, including Japan, Germany, and Britain, also rallied. Bond yields fell as prices rose. The US dollar, which fell sharply on Thursday, 3rd of April, rebounded somewhat, but remains near its weakest levels of the year.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. Every day we are met with a new heartbreak and horrors, says the engineer from Gaza, Sabreen Shabbat. But we remind ourselves that to remain steadfast because we are Palestinians, she adds. Here is a story of a woman who is keen to speak for all women of Gaza.
Sabreen's story isn't just her own. It is the story of all Palestinian women, Not showing her full identity is her way of telling the world she's a faceless face of all Gazan women who've experienced genocide. It's the story of a thousand like her, family-focused, fierce of spirit and of intellect. Sabrine may choose to screen her face, but the full glare of her experience living on the tyranny has been exposed for all to see. In what has become something of a theme, Gaza's women are some of the most educated, a feat even more impressive for the obstacles endured just to have the right to learn. Sabrine's hard work was paying off. Despite the challenges, she had ambitions to go further, for more. Life in a genocide is a new kind of horror. Survival is simply the beginning of a nightmarish hellscape. The world's failings on Palestine have been noted, most solemnly by the Palestinians who found themselves living under a genocide as life carried on as normal elsewhere. The act of constant displacement, of leaving everything behind in an attempt to escape with your life, takes a heavy toll. The thing they probably don't tell you about living under the shadow of munitions exploding, bodies being broken, a genocide as your shadow, is how your spirit is beaten, even if your body defies the odds and remains intact. The latest round of Israeli aggression has not just robbed Palestinians of the here and now, but by reducing their lives to the most base elements of survival, Palestinians are robbed of a future filled with hopes and dreams. The trauma experienced by those who survived the genocide will require generations to unpack. Mothers, sisters, daughters, sons have all lived through months upon months of a Western-created tragedy one would not wish on their enemies, except perhaps the ones created for political expediency. Sabrine has seen the worst, but strives to live to honor those who are not as fortunate. Sabrine wants us to embrace the things we hold most dear. Create memories. Tomorrow isn't guaranteed, but as long as there's life, there must be hope.
Joining me in the studio today to discuss Sabrine's story is Fatima Hilo. She's a British Palestinian filmmaker. Welcome, Fatima. Fatima, this Sabrine talks about the hope and the strength she has, which we've seen in a lot of Palestinians, and to stay steadfast on the path of resistance. But she equates this to her identity as a Palestinian. Now, you as a Palestinian yourself, can you explain this spirit to us?
Well, I share this identity simply because I am also Palestinian, as you've said, and I'm from there. And Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, said, "I come from there. I have a home, I have a window, and a prison." So that is, this is the beautiful and the powerful reflection on identity. Palestinian identity, like any other, is a combination of history, culture, traditional, and the shared experience of a people. But what makes it especially striking is that it has continuously threatened by, displacement, occupation, and attempts to erase it. Yet, despite this, Palestinians have held onto their identity with remarkable strength. It is the embroidery, the embroidered dresses, what every stretch tells the story of a village or a city, carrying the heritage of generations. It is the kufiya, not just a scarf, but a symbol of the resistance, which you are talking about, the struggle and the unity.
Do you feel that the fact that, you know, there is this fight for survival specifically?
Definitely.
That is what makes you more strong?
Definitely. Palestinian identity is not just about culture and aggression and you know, expression. Thought it is also deeply tied in the land to the you know, to the names of villages, the streets, the olive trees, the, you know, the stood fasting for the centuries. You know, they've been struggling, and you know, this is the oral history passed down from elders who you know, who remember what, you know, once was, and even for those, you know, exile, it carried, you know, in memory, it carried in language, in belonging for the return, the, you know, Sabrina's strings like that of so many Palestinians comes from this deep rooted identity. It is the identity, is an identity that has been shaped by the struggle, but also by an unbreakable connection to heritage, to history, and hope. And that's why, no matter, you know, how much hardship they face, Palestinians continue to hold into their traditions, because identity is not just because it's about, you know, past, but also about the future, and the determine of to, and they determine to protect it.
Absolutely. How much of a faith do you think plays a role here? Because do you think that it is the fact, like, you know, when I struggle to see what is going on in Palestine right now, you know, with the tragedy we see happening, is the way I see it is that, you know, we are all transitional into this world. We only have to think about our role and, you know, what we can do, what are we supposed to do, what really eventually happens and the solution is found, we leave it upon God. You know, do you think this belief in God is probably what also helps in this fighting spirit, in this resilience?
It's more about the strength, you know, like, you know, absolutely, you're right. Sabrine's pain is not just her own. It is reflection of a much, you know, larger struggle, one that history has shown can repeat itself, and in if injustice, you know, going on and, you know, left unchecked, for instance. And today it's Gaza, tomorrow it could be anywhere. It could be, you know, when world turns it, a blind eyes to oppression, it sets a dangerous precedent,
absolutely,
you know, that allows inhumanity to spread. And the loss of innocent lives, children, doctors, youth, people, engineers, like, you know, like Sabrine, is not just a loss for Palestine, but for humanity, as a whole. You know, these are not the people who shape the future.
Absolutely. And we're going to come back to that, Fatima, just to remind our viewers, you are watching Women of Resistance, where we highlight the plight of women who were subjected to a genocide in Gaza. Let's move to a more personal story of yours, Fatima. You are a Palestinian. Mm-hmm. Every Palestinian has got their own story. You know, tell us about your Palestinian story and the work you do.
Well, I'm a filmmaker. I'm a Palestinian of origin and British citizen. I'm a filmmaker. I'm an activist. I am a survivor. I am you name it, you know, a journalist, and I've been through all what Sabrine's actually been through. I was born and grew up in exile in the refugee camp, the infamous refugee camp in Lebanon called Sabra and Shatila. I witnessed the massacre that happened in September 1982 there. I lost part of my family in the camp. I was forced when I was a child to walk on the dead bodies, you know, when I was, you know, very young, to see all of this atrocity, and forced and used as a human shield, you know, in the camp in order the Israelis to get into the camp. However, that did not stop me. The same as Sabrine said, this is not like going to hold us, but it's going to encourage us. It may, you know, delay us to achieve our hope and our dream, But still, actually, we will do it. Sabrine's case, she went to the university after 18 years of, you know, of staying, you know, looking after her family.
Yeah.
This is amazing, you know, she kept this dream, she kept this resistance and strength. And that where every Palestinian has this encouragement, because we need to create our future, we need to reach our dream, and that's what it is.
Fatima, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering, it's amazing, and we have seen this repeatedly, this resilience and strength, you know. But sometimes when you've been through, for example, what you say about, you know, walking over dead bodies, this breaks the strongest of people. Sometimes, you know, mental health issues, it stops you from, you know, achieving more. But we don't see that in you, Palestinians. We just see it fueling more and more, you know, spirit of resistance. How do you do it?
We do it actually because we don't have, when you are in this situation, you don't have time to think about it. You need to do it. You need to go for it. You need to keep going. Otherwise, it's gonna break you. And that's why the strength, the commitment, you know, the belief, the resistance is our weapon to keep going on and to keep our life live, basically, to continue and to go forward and look for the future. It held you back, yes, to get your dream, but that does not stop you. You know, it keeps you going. Otherwise, it will break you.
Because there is no other option than to fight for the freedom of Palestine.
There is no other option, and you have to be unbreakable. Yeah. That is the issue. That's the most important for us.
Absolutely. How do we help, you know, like women who are in Gaza at the moment in the condition of Sabrine, for example? We see that, for example, she's got this GoFundMe, account, but she's saying it's not doing too well. People are not really donating money. But you see a lot of, you know, people want to help out. Do you think it's the trust factor of donating online? What really is it?
Well, it's quite a lot of combination. First of all is, you know, the holding of the, you know, the power of the occupation is affecting the contribution for the people and the mistrust. Of course, sometimes they try to break you. They try not to allow you to get any fund. But also, it's not just this. It's about you know, women need support, especially the Palestinians. Through organization, they need a contribute organization that dedicate to aiding Palestinian women, not just, you know, keeping them struggling and struggling and going on like that. Mm-hmm. You need a plan for this, and you need an organization, an institution that can adopt these people, like Sabrine, like me, because we are struggling even to do some films nowadays because of the lack of fund, the lack of credibility and trust. We need advocate, we need education for girls and women as well in our
Absolutely.
Culture and our community.
Yeah.
The problem is we have a lot of, as I said, a lot of preventing us. Some of them is like, you know, amplifying, like, you know, we need amplifying the voice of women as well.
Absolutely.
This is very important.
Yeah.
But also be in mind, occupation is making it really difficult as well.
Yes.
I'm going to give an example about a lady who was, you know, recently killed in her house in France. She's a journalist. She's a filmmaker. She was doing a film, documentary film about Gaza recently. Her name is Marine Fedhovich. And she was found in her house.
Absolutely.
Died,
I mean, Fatima, the struggles of the Palestinian women are manifold. There is threats everywhere. But honestly, I have to end this by saying to you, you know, hats off to you, women of Palestine.
Thank you.
And on that, thank you so much for joining us. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye. Thank you.
Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Peer pressure. Yes, dear teens, we know you are not always surrounded by positive people, good people, or sometimes come under pressure. And we are here to help you through how you can go with these scenarios. Well, in the previous episode, we reached the conclusion that on that day, people will be crying from the hellfire. Woe to me, I wish I didn't choose this and this particular person as my Khalil, as my friend. So be careful in choosing friends and be careful coming under this pressure because the consequences are very, very bad. And whenever you choose to do something, look at the consequences first. That's just off the previous episode, and we'll continue with the same
Brother Liaquat, again, the stage is all yours.
So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, when it is said about the verse of the Holy Quran, where a person is going to say, grief be upon me. So he will wish for grief on that day. And the grief is because of choosing so-and-so person and a few friends, example, as a friend in when he was alive in this world or she was alive in this world. So, you know, if we, as parents or educators, example, we it's a kind of responsibility. I would say it's a wajib responsibility to teach our children, to teach our teens especially, because now that they're going to become baligh, example, or they have passed the stage of bulugh,
right.
They are matured now, and they know what feelings are, example, and they can really distinguish between genders now, and they know what are inclinations and everything, right? So, so example, when we tell them about smoking, okay, as parents or educators, when we tell them, you know what, smoking is not allowed, okay? It's really something which I don't accept it to happen. Likewise, I don't accept drinking. Likewise, it's not just me, it's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's the Ahlul Bayt, it's the Holy Quran. So if you are drinking, example, you're going against everything, it's haram. The concept of haram should be introduced before itself. Example, the concept of haram should be introduced, I would say, from the childhood itself, you know. What is haram, what is not allowed. And example, it should be taught to the child in a manner that, you know what, this is something bad, and you know, you are such a good person, and you don't like it. You know how it is, the law of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. We say the child, you know, the Ahlul Bayt are very good, they are they are very nice,
noble,
and they are from Allah,
kind,
you see,
yeah.
We love them. Likewise, how we are teaching love of Ahlul Bayt to our kids, love of the Holy Quran to our kids, likewise we teach what is not allowed as well. You know, alcohol is very bad, those people are very bad, example, you see. And we shouldn't be going to those kind of people, and we shouldn't be listening if someone tells us to, example, go towards it and drink it, example, you see.
Yeah.
So when a person gets a list of what a haram, example, and what a haram in today's world are really astonishing, and you know, they are like updated,
right?
Back in our days, example, like when we are when we were children, this internet and this kind of technology was not available.
Yes,
in those days, like haram was something else, okay? It was kind of fantasy, maybe, if a person has to go and commit something haram. But in today's world, haram is very easy to be committed, example, you see,
right? Yeah, yeah. We'll discuss more on that. Let's take a short break here.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman, don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul سينين وخالقنا وراسقنا وهو على كل شيء قدير.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat, you said a very important point before going to the break. You said that in today's world, access to haram is so available, it's so out there. And in like, for example, back in our days, it was a fantasy. The things that those were fantasies. Our teens today are living those fantasies, actually, and it's really hard to hold back. So yeah, we would want you to give us some strategies so that our teens do not come under this peer pressure. For example, they live in good families, they come from good families, but still the peer pressure is something that sometimes drags you.
Yeah, as parents or educators, example, if we teach them to have patience, just like we teach them to have patience in hardship, if we teach them to have patience if there is a sin in front of us, example, then that will really help us. Just like, you know, of course, we even if we don't use the word patience, okay, if we are just saying you have to get rid of it, You can't go towards it, okay? If we are saying in this manner, it means that, okay, I should be having patience if something is put forward in front of me, like, which is a
right,
sin, okay?
Right.
So, of course, there are different stages and there are different levels of patience according to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. One of them
right.
is patience when we are confronted with a sin.
When
okay.
you have all the grounds.
When you have all the grounds to commit a sin and you still don't want to commit
right.
it and you are not committing it. And also patience in obligatory acts, example, patience in hardships.
Well,
like
human is a kind of like he gets tempted and, you know, we are made in a way that we get tempted easily.
Yes.
But it's like even if your heart wants,
mm-hmm.
even if you feel like, okay, maybe this will give me some kind of pleasure for some time. I'll get some kind of, you know, entertainment for some time and
mm-hmm.
I don't know, just get out of stress or other things. But when you say to yourself, okay, calm down on this, that's actually what we call as patience and sins.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? This thing example is very important to be put forward in the beginning stage itself. Example, you know, the pressure comes on a teen, okay, for a particular sin, and the sin is not yet tasted by this particular teen, okay? If he or she has already tasted, the tendency to commit the sin or to go under pressure increases. Is a lot, yeah? But example, if the teen has never ever drank alcohol, I'm just giving a simple example, then the teen might say, I don't want to drink it at all. Why? Because the upbringing has happened in such a manner. You know what? The parents or the educators are like, you know what? Alcohol is haram. You can't drink even a drop of it. You can't even taste it. Tasting a drop of alcohol is also haram. Likewise, if we put forward in this manner, if we put forward in front of our teens all the examples, example, the group of people or the group of teens or group of classmates tell something to be searched on website, on social media, which is not allowed according to Islam. If the educator or the parents know this thing and like before itself, they create grounds in order that the teen knows the boundaries. So if we don't train our kids or if we don't do upbringing in such a manner, the teen doesn't know whether this is halal or haram even. He gets pressurized, he commits something.
Maybe
and
I'm
he
getting
gets
into
that,
dark
that kind of I would say desire to commit it once again.
Right.
See? So it's our responsibility to draw that line before itself.
Right.
So that the teen is not pressurized and is not going to go in that manner.
Right. We'll take a short break and we'll be back in a while.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaqat Abbas is here with us. He is telling us the strategies to overcome peer pressure. Yes.
Yes, sister. So, another example, what happens is a student is pressurized by peers or classmates to cheat on a test. So, with friends insisting that everyone is doing it. So, they're going to say, oh, you know what? Only you are not
participating in the cheating.
Yeah, exactly. You're not showing your answers. Everyone else are sharing their answers in this, in the examination. Yeah, in the examination hall, and it's just one time thing. Like, just show it for once. Like, it's just for today. I'm not gonna ask you anymore. You see, I'm not gonna bother you in the next exam because I know it beforehand. It's, for example, it's an easy subject.
Yeah.
But you know, when it comes to that day, again, it's the same thing going on. Again,
yeah.
It's the same cassette or recorder which says, oh, you know what? It's just for today. Show your answers only for today, only for this exam. I promise you, I'm not going to ask. So this is a kind of pressure, again, which is built upon a teen, you see, or a child even. So one thing which we have to, or the student has to remind himself or herself, is about the importance of honesty over here. Number one, importance of honesty. How honest are we towards our examination? And on the other hand, let me tell you very fairly and very frankly, and that is copying, cheating in examination is haram. According to the fatwa or according to the rules of Maharaj, in Islam, example, copying, cheating, showing answers, copying answers, looking at answers, copying them on an answer sheet is haram.
Haram.
Simple. Yeah. Be it on an academic level, be it on an Islamic level, be it on whatever level. So copying is haram in examination. So being fair is very important.
Yes.
So you know the boundaries are laid by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala over here. Okay.
Yes.
So if someone is asking us to cross those boundaries, of course our intellect will say no. Simple no. Okay, I don't know the answer. So let me be honest with myself. I have to accept the truth that I'm going to get less marks. Or even if I'm going to fail, I have to accept it. Why? Because I didn't learn properly. I didn't train myself in such a manner that I can write answers in a good manner, you see. So I have to be honest, and honesty is very important. And you know what? Honesty is something which should be taught by our parents, which should be taught by our educators. It's okay. Be honest to yourself, even if you fail in your
exam.
Even
if the consequences are awkward.
It's okay. Yeah. At least you are not going to end up in the consequences of the hereafter.
Right.
If you cheat, you're going to get sin and stuff. At least you're not going to go into that extent.
Right.
You're going to just lose few marks. That's it. You see?
Yeah.
So if
the consequences are going to be small.
Very small.
Right.
And you know, even the parents are going to be like, okay, next time work hard. Like this time it's okay.
Yeah.
But next time, and they are more keen to upon their teen that they progress even more.
Right.
And not fail in the next exam. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. That was all the time we had for today. Dear teens, remember, Surah Zalzal says, we will be rewarded or punished for the acts which are even of the atom size. So be aware of your actions, and be that through pressure or be that any action, be aware of your actions. Thank you for listening. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Imagine a gas so rare, but so incredibly important and necessary for cutting-edge medical equipment, space exploration, and even quantum computing. Bet you weren't thinking about helium now, were you? But helium is the topic for this week's episode of Iran Tech. This incredibly valuable resource that is very difficult to find. You can mostly find it in natural gas, but the extraction process is one that only very few countries in the world have access to. Only those who have access to great many natural gas reserves. And in this week's episode of Iran Tech, we've come to the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, who are the pioneers of this extraction procedure, to find out how important helium is and how the extraction process works. So why is helium so difficult to extract? Well, for one, it's an inert gas, meaning it doesn't really bond with anything. That means we can't use typical adsorption and absorption methods to get it to stick to something and in that way extract it from natural gas. Also, it is very light and very elusive, and once it escapes, it is gone for good. So traditionally, what we've been doing to procure the helium required for the country's use in perhaps the medical sector, for example, is to import it from countries like Qatar, who are one of the top exporters of helium. We also have the U.S., which is another top exporter of helium. And the common thing between these two countries is that they both have extremely good access to a large reserve of natural gas. And so it was only natural for us, with having the second largest natural gas reserve in the world, to enter the picture. And that's exactly what we've done, pioneered by the efforts of the scientists of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. So in a little bit, we will show you exactly how we've managed to extract helium from our natural gas.
Helium is one of the rarest gases on Earth, not because it's hard to make, but because it's so elusive. Yet, hidden deep underground, nature has been producing helium for billions of years. Unlike most elements, helium doesn't come from chemical reactions. It's created through radioactive decay, deep within the Earth's crust. It all starts with heavy elements, uranium and thorium, trapped inside rocks. Over millions of years, these elements slowly break down in a process called radioactive decay. As they decay, they release alpha particles, tiny clusters of protons and neutrons. Alpha particles don't stay as they are. As they move through rock, they capture electrons from their surroundings, transforming into helium atoms. But helium is incredibly light, and it doesn't like to stay put. It seeps upward, slipping through cracks in the Earth's crust. Most of it keeps rising until it reaches the surface and drifts off into space, lost forever. In rare cases, thick layers of rock act like a lid, trapping helium underground for millions, sometimes even billions of years. Over time, these helium pockets mix with natural gas, creating the reserves we mine today. Helium is a silent gift from the depth of the Earth, billions of years in the making.
As you are aware, over 90% of the world's helium reserves are located in our country, yet we have not been able to extract this helium. The mission assigned to us at the Atomic Energy Organization is to harness this divine resource. As you can see in the pilot facility behind me, we aim to extract helium using cryogenic methods. Helium, derived from natural gas, has numerous applications, including as a coolant in nuclear reactors, as well as in welding, diving, research balloons, and detectors. The methods for helium extraction are primarily from natural gas, and here we are employing cryogenic techniques. For this method, the natural gas must first be purified. It is then cooled to temperatures of minus 50 degrees Celsius and minus 180 degrees Celsius using heat exchangers. We can achieve this using equipment developed domestically within the Atomic Energy Organization. Through distillation towers, we further increase its purity to the highest possible level. The equipment used in this pilot project is entirely based on indigenous engineering, design, and manufacturing expertise. At the Atomic Energy Organization, we have successfully developed and operationalized these systems.
The method of choice for helium extraction here is called cryogenic distillation. What happens first is we bring CNG, compressed natural gas, and we inject them into these adsorption towers. Adsorption because the medium for adsorption is solid. If it were liquid, it would have been called absorption tower. Now, what is it supposed to adsorb? Well, the CNG has a lot of impurities in it that we don't want in the purification process. So in this first step, all of those impurities, which are mainly CO2, are adsorbed by the solid that is in this tower. So what we have outside of this adsorption tower into the heat exchanger is pure CNG, not pure helium, pure CNG. And in this heat exchanging chamber, we add liquid nitrogen to the temperature of minus 180 degrees Celsius. Now this liquid nitrogen brings down the temperature of the CNG to minus 80 degrees in the first stage, and this minus 80 degrees gas then is transferred into the distillation chamber, the distillation tower, and through certain processes of evaporation and distillation, we take advantage of the extremely low boiling points of helium, which is minus 269 Celsius, and its comparatively much higher boiling point of LNG, and through this distillation and evaporation, what we get from this first phase of distillation is LNG out of the distillation tower. But we have to re-inject the remaining CNG, which now has a higher purity of helium, down from a 0.04% to 0.06%, all the way up to 1% after the first stage of heat exchange and distillation. So we re-inject the remaining CNG with higher purity of helium to the heat exchanger. Now the liquid nitrogen brings down the temperature of the CNG to minus 180 degrees flat, then reintroduce it back into the distillation tower for another batch of distillation and evaporation. And what we get out of this second phase is 70% helium with some LNG that is going to be essentially reintroduced back into the gas grid of the whole country. So this is only two stages of distillation because it's happening in a lab, in a controlled environment, as a pilot. Once it is applied at a factory scale, we will need to add a couple more stages to bring up the purity of helium to grade 5, 99.999% purity. But this was supposed to be a proof of concept. Now let's take a closer look at the inner workings of this facility to take a closer look at what happens inside of these chambers.
After we've achieved 70% purity using cryogenic distillation at the lab scale, the next steps in a factory setting involve further purification and concentration to achieve high-quality helium, often referred to as grade 5 helium, with a purity of 99.999%. In a factory, once we've distilled the gas down to the desired concentration, the next step is the use of pressure swing adsorption, or PSA, and temperature swing adsorption, or TSA. These methods use specialized adsorbent materials to selectively capture impurities from the helium gas. Pressure swing adsorption, or PSA, works by pressurizing the gas and passing it through an adsorbent bed, which binds and removes residual impurities like nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrocarbons. Once the impurities are trapped, the system releases the pure helium under lower pressure, ensuring that we collect the highest purity possible. This is done in multiple cycles to ensure that only the helium remains. On the other hand, temperature swing adsorption, or TSA, uses heat to change the adsorption properties of the material, allowing it to release any remaining contaminants when heated, while still retaining the helium. This process is used to polish the gas further, removing any trace impurities that may have escaped the PSA step. By combining PSA and TSA, we can achieve helium with grade 5 purity suitable for high-tech applications. Once the helium is purified, it's then liquefied and stored in tanks under high pressure, ready for transportation. The liquid helium is transported and eventually regasified for various industrial, scientific, and medical uses.
The primary goal of this project is to establish a plant capable of producing 20 tons of liquid helium per year. Liquid helium production generally involves four main stages. Helium extraction from natural gas following initial purification. Secondary purification to produce grade 5 helium. Final purification and liquefaction. The pilot facility here is designed to validate design data and ensure its accuracy. We are currently implementing the first two stages, helium extraction and initial purification, at this site. For this purpose, we have adopted cryogenic distillation towers, the globally predominant method for helium extraction from natural gas. Internationally, helium is often obtained as a byproduct of LNG plants. Typically, flash drums are first used to produce LNG, which contains approximately 5% helium, before further processing stages yield pure helium. Due to a lack of domestic expertise in designing such distillation towers, we built this pilot facility to gather essential data. The pilot comprises three main sections for the subsequent industrial phase. Absorption towers to remove impurities like CO2 and other gases from the feedstock. Heat exchangers to cool the natural gas until it liquefies. Distillation columns to separate a helium-enriched stream from the liquefied gas. At the inlet, helium concentration is approximately 200 to 400 parts per million, 0.04 to 0.06% by volume. After optimizing parameters in the main plant, we aim to increase this to 1 to 5%. In the second distillation column, purity is further elevated to 70%. Key data under analysis include optimizing inlet gas treatment conditions, e.g., removing CO2 and other impurities, operational parameters for distillation towers, pressure, flow rates, tray design, etc. We have also gained critical experience in manufacturing ultra-low temperature heat exchangers through this pilot, which will inform the industrial scale phase. God willing, once the main plant is operational, we will meet the nation's demand for liquid helium. Regarding the main plant, the basic design phase developed in collaboration with Sharif University has been completed. We are now advancing into the detailed engineering design phase. With data from this pilot, we will secure licensing and design expertise for helium production units in Iran, enabling deployment of such facilities nationwide in regions with natural gas reserves. By God's grace, this project will position Iran as a self-sufficient producer of liquid helium, eliminating reliance on foreign sources.
Before recording this episode, I gotta be honest, the only thing that I thought helium was really used for is, you know, you inhale it and it makes your voice sound funny. But hopefully by now we've been able to depict just how much of a strategic resource helium can be and how only countries with great access to natural gas reserves can ever hope to be producers and eventually exporters of helium. And right now the wheels are already in motion to make that factory, based on the data collected in this initial pilot phase, to be able to fulfill the needs of the country in terms of helium fully. And we can then hope to become exporters of helium because we have the natural gas to back it up. And with that said, thank you. I'll see you guys next week.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters,